This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As Congress gets set to resume debate on the war here in Washington this week, no one will forget that American losses now total more than 4,000 in Iraq. But few of us know what happens to those men and women between the moment they die and the moment their remains are laid to rest. From a soldier's buddies who carry him off the battlefield on a stretcher to mortuary workers, truck drivers, pilots, honor guards, and the chaplains that console them all. Esquire magazine staff writer Chris Jones followed one soldier's body from the spot where he died near Baghdad to his final resting place in his hometown of Scottsburg, Indiana. His article, The Things That Carried Him, appears in the May issue. Later in the program, reparations for slavery on the opinion page this week after Florida Governor Charlie Crist said he'd consider the idea, some practical suggestions for what might actually get done. But first, a soldier's last trip home. If you're involved in the transfer of bodies and remains of military personnel, or if you're a family member who's been through this process, call and tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Chris Jones joins us now from the studios at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in Ottawa, Canada. And nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me.
And let's begin with a phrase we learn in your article, honorable transfer. What does that mean?
Specifically, there's a ceremony where the military finally hands the body of the soldier or the sailor or the airman or the Marine back to the family. And that specific instance, that actual giving of the casket, is an honorable transfer. But there are several stages in the journey where similar ceremonies take place. For instance, when the planes arrive at Dover, Delaware, every casualty is brought there to be prepared for burial to the Air Force base. And for instance, when those caskets, or actually transfer cases, are removed from the plane there, that's also an honorable transfer ceremony.
And it's a process that few people have seen. Indeed, I guess a few years ago, the Pentagon caused quite a stir by forbidding photographs of coffins being brought back from Iraq.
That's right. What's funny, though, is that when I started work on the story, I thought there would be all sorts of roadblocks thrown up. And very early on, I was told I needed Pentagon approval, and I kind of decided then that the story wasn't going to happen. But I called up Lieutenant Colonel Melnick at Mortuary Affairs at the Pentagon and talked to him for about 2 minutes and had full approval to work on the story. So It's not a story. The people involved certainly are not ashamed of the work that they do. I think justifiably they're proud of what they do. But there certainly is this stigma attached to the idea that we can't see what's going on, that we can't follow this journey. I didn't find that to be the case.
You also decide to tell your story backwards. You begin with the funeral of an American soldier and then go back and trace the path that he took from the battlefield where he was killed in Baghdad. Why did you decide to tell it that way?
To be honest, I was worried that people would put the story down. It's a long story and it's very heavy, and I understand that it's tough reading. And in my mind, I thought that the part of the journey that most people are familiar with would be the funeral. We can picture in our minds the bugler playing taps or the flag being folded. So we know that part. But I thought by reversing it, by starting with what we know and tracing back to the moment of this soldier's death, Sergeant Joe Montgomery, I thought it might be some way to keep people reading along, that they would sort of be compelled to finish at the start of the journey, if that makes any sense.
There was one part of that funeral, that last scene. You say we all know that. Well, there was something I didn't know. Tell us a little bit about the Patriot Guard.
I want to tell you that everyone I talked to for this story made an impression on me. It's a strangely life-affirming story in some ways because you realize how good people can be. And, you know, some of those people in this story were the Patriot Guard riders. These are motorcyclists. Some are veterans, some are not, who have volunteered to escort the coffins. For instance, frequently they land at an airport, that's some distance from the hometown. They'll escort the casket from the airport to the hometown, and they'll also attend the funeral, sort of as a honor guard. They started up because of, I don't like to give them any publicity, but a certain church in Kansas that began protesting soldiers' funerals, and the Patriot Guard sort of decided to act as shields for the family so they wouldn't have to see that or hear that. But since then, it's evolved so that just about every funeral there will be motorcyclists, regular people who just have taken it upon themselves to be there for that final trip home.
You tell us any number of other stories about the funeral too, about the bugler, about the others in the honor guard there at the service in the cemetery. But there's also a very moving story about the progress of the remains through the town on the way to the cemetery. And you tell us about two motorcycle cops. I'm just looking for their names here.
The Barkley brothers.
Yes, indeed, the Barkley brothers who lead the procession, the long cortege.
In this case, Scottsburg, Indiana is a small town in southern Indiana, and in this case, Sergeant Montgomery was flown into a town called Seymour, which is a little over 20 miles north of Scottsburg. And there was a procession starting from the airport, led by these motorcycle troopers, the Barkley brothers. The procession in this instance was actually 3 miles long, if you total everybody from the police escorts to the hearses to the family members to the Patriot Guard riders. And what happened was, as they traveled down the interstate, sort of the main road between Indianapolis and Louisville, Kentucky, it shut down. The officers shut down the southbound lanes where the procession was traveling. But almost by, accident, the northbound lanes virtually shut down as well. News sort of traveled over truckers' radios and traffic helicopters. And the family found that as they drove south, that the overpasses were crowded with people, with volunteer firefighters, with trucks with their ladders raised, but also regular families had pulled over, truckers had pulled over, farmers had driven across fields to get close to the shoulder of the interstate to salute Joey, to welcome him home.
And several people in your article observed the smaller the town, the bigger the turnout.
Yeah, that seems to always be the case. It's a shame, really, that in some cases the loss of a soldier is disappears. It just gets lost in the chaos of daily life. In this instance, Scottsburg is a town of 6,000. Joey's uncle happens to be the mayor of Scottsburg. His mom, Gail, is a presence in the community, and everybody who I talked to said that virtually the whole town had turned out, that the streets were shoulder to shoulder, and in fact, the hearse, when leaving the church going to the cemetery, took a circuitous route through town, so that everybody could pay their respects.
We're talking with Chris Jones, a writer for Esquire magazine. His story, The Things That Carried Him, appears in the May issue of the magazine. If you'd like to join our conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. We'll begin with Jonathan. Jonathan calling us from Denver, Colorado.
Yeah, hi. Chris, thank you so much for writing this article. I haven't read it yet, but I'm glad to hear that you got it through. I just wanted to share my story. I was actually a Black Hawk pilot at Fort Belvoir, and we had to take the honor guard out to Dover as one of our regular missions. And my father was a Vietnam veteran who protested the war when he got back, and I kind of had similar feelings about Iraq, even though I was still in the Army. And he pointed out to me one day that, nobody sees the body bags coming home. And he said that was extremely important in the Vietnam protest. And I said, well, that's funny, Dad. I see the bodies coming home all the time. And so I wrote an article about it, and I got published in U.S. News.
Okay.
I don't know if you ever saw that, Chris, in your research, but that was when the Pentagon was really stonewalling the issue. And I actually ended up having to get it approved through Rumsfeld's office. And my whole point in the article was, I don't care whether you're for or against the war, but I think you need to know the cost of it. And I even kind of paid a little bit of credit to the Secretary of Defense's office for the blackout, because I understood that, to have a media spectacle here is somehow obtuse equally as leaving it blacked out. And I called it, the infotainment industry, basically trying to sort of sensationalize it.
Yeah, and Chris, the way you describe that moment where the coffin comes off the plane there at Dover, an incredibly emotional moment for everybody involved, and you could see how people would be upset to have cameras there.
Yeah, it's a I don't know how to explain. As a journalist, I want people to know this story. I agree that I think it's easy for us to forget what's going on, and that there's something particularly stark about seeing flag draped aluminum cases coming off a plane with bodies inside. And those planes that land at Dover, they can have anywhere from, you know, there might be a single soldier in the belly of that plane. The people I talked to, the biggest plane load they saw were 42. You know, it's a flying cemetery at times. And I think people need to know that. They need to be confronted by that. But at the same time, I do understand how a family might not want those kind of photographs taken. And the families that I did speak to, they talked often about how they can't escape, you know, the memory of this loss. They're constantly confronted by it. Every time there's news about Iraq or a picture of a flag-draped casket, they're brought back to that moment. So I'm not sure where that line is. I do think it's important that people know this story. I'm proud to have told this story. But I do understand the need for respect there. And another point I'd like to make about Dover is that even though there is no camera there, there is no audience, those guys, the honor guards there, do an incredible job of welcoming home these soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines with respect. It's the same ceremony. One casket, 42 caskets, it's the same ceremony every single time out, and it's a pretty incredible process.
The detail, and Jonathan, by the way, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
The detail with which people all along the path pay attention to this process is remarkable. You describe a scene where I think a young woman is polishing the brass buttons on the uniform of a soldier who's going to be buried. And someone says, well, his family will appreciate that. And she said, no, they won't. He's going to be cremated.
Yeah. I mean, I heard stories of the preparation of remains is an incredibly intimate process. And for me, that was in some ways some of the most moving, some of the more moving stories that I heard, because I think 99% of Americans probably do not know that the Port Mortuary exists. They probably do not know that everybody is prepared in this single building in Dover, Delaware. Is probably the most important American building that the fewest people know about. And the work that goes on there is incredible work. I mean, these are not people who have died in their sleep. These are people who have died unnaturally, and the work that has to be done to put them back together, to present them back to the families, is hard work, and these guys do an incredible job at it.
We're speaking with Chris Jones. He followed Joe Montgomery on his last trip home after his death in Iraq. Call and tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The images of a soldier's body returning home are iconic and indelible. The long flight home in the belly of the cargo plane, the salute to a flag-draped coffin. Today we're speaking with writer Chris Jones, who followed the journey of one fallen soldier from Iraq to Dover Air Force Base to the Collins Funeral Home in Indiana. You can find a link to his article. It appears in the May issue of Esquire magazine on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And if you've been through this process, call and tell us your story. We'd also like to talk with people who participate in the process. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Patrick. Patrick with us from Remsen in New York.
How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you.
When I was in the service, I was in the 10th Mountain Division when the Afghanistan offensive first started. And I had the distinct honor and privilege to be on a funeral detail team for a period of 2 months, doing mostly the Northeast, New England, and New York State. And we probably performed between 45 and 50 funeral services. And most of our veterans were actually deceased from, they were actually from prior wars, Korean War, World War II. In one instance, we had a young man who was killed in Afghanistan, but I just wanted to relate what a moving experience it was to even be a part of it. And forever in my mind, it'll be the pinnacle of my military career that I was actually able to serve so many veterans at one time.
The funeral detail, not your service in Afghanistan.
No, sir. No, funeral detail is going to stick in my mind as the greatest thing I did in my military career.
And why do you think that?
It's probably the thank you get from the families afterwards. These people had, you know, been hit by such a hard loss, but But after all is said and done, the warm thank yous, sometimes the homemade cookies or the fellow veterans inviting us down to the American Legion Hall or the VFW Hall, even though we weren't allowed to actually fall them down, but we were extremely appreciative, and it's just such a an old and solemn tradition that is kept alive in this country. I think it's one of the most beautiful traditions in the military today.
After a dozen, two dozen funerals, doesn't this get to you?
The first one really did, because they started, I'm an Irish boy, so they started playing, once they started playing Amazing Grace on the bagpipes, I started tearing up. But after that, you sort of gain your composure, and you get it done, and you know you've put one of your brothers to bed in the highest traditions of the United States military.
Patrick, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
And Chris Jones, like Patrick, who we were just speaking to, there is not a trace of irony or distance in any of the people you write about in this article.
No. That was one of the things that surprised me about the story. You hear about Patrick tearing up there, hearing Amazing Grace and the bagpipes. I thought the people involved in this process would have built up walls, that they would have been insulated from the job that they're doing. And part of that is true. They develop something that a lot of them called a sustainable focus. You sort of look beyond what you're doing. You sort of think about the family. You think about bringing this young man or woman home honorably. You think about the job that you're doing. But all of them let it affect them. All of them let it wash over them. And I was surprised by that. I just thought you wouldn't be able to do the job if you took it in. But I think the truth is that unless you take it in, you can't do the job. In order to do it properly, you have to feel it.
Another thing I did not know was that the Army Chiefs of Staff had issued an order that everybody returning home to Dover must be met by a general officer, and then a general officer must also attend the funeral.
That's right. And I think that's, everyone I talked to agreed that that was a good idea, because not only is that an honor for the family, but I think what it does is it serves to remind generals who might be, buried in an office in the Pentagon of the human cost of war. I think even generals, one of my more powerful interviews was with General Richard Formica in a boardroom in the Pentagon. He was the general who met Sergeant Montgomery's plane at Dover. And here's this two-star general with a voice that would make you quake, tearing up, talking about greeting these planes. And I think, the fact that it affects even someone as hardened as he might be really struck me.
Let's go to Dennis. Dennis with us on the phone from Santa Rosa in California.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, and good afternoon our time, but good morning your time. Go ahead.
And I've got two basic comments. I'm a Gold Star parent. My son was killed in Iraq a couple of years ago, and just want to say that the community response at midnight when my son's body was brought home, there was an escort from San Francisco International all the way up to Santa Rosa, and the turnout was just tremendous, as your guest was saying. There was helicopters, police, firemen, and just normal civilians. That's the first comment. Second comment is there was another incident up here with another soldier who was killed, whose family hired a gentleman to do a horse escort of the casket, and I use the term loosely, gentlemen, hired some protesters to protest along the street as the body was being taken to be buried.
He hired protesters?
That's exactly right. And he's a well-known activist in the area, and he did that. And that is one reason why, privacy of this thing is such a key issue, is because there will be people who will take advantage of the publicity. And it is not only painful for some people involved, but it can even make some people very angry.
Dennis, we're sorry again for the loss of your son.
Well, we're proud of him and his service, but it is a tremendous loss. You're right.
Thanks very much for the phone call.
Okay, good morning. Thank
Bye-bye.
You for the program. Bye.
Not just that incident, which seems anomalous to me, but more to the point, the emotions of families involved. You describe families that the parents were involved in a bitter divorce, no one showed up, or a family of immigrants, you say, who opposed their son's decision to join the Army and had to vent their grief in a very personal way by battering his aluminum casing as it came off the plane. Scenes like that, which make it much more difficult to imagine this, that these would be exposed to the public.
Yeah. Again, it's walking that line that the story of the family. Since January 1st, 2007, it used to be that the bodies were returned by commercial jet, that they might be in the belly of a United plane or a Delta plane. Since January 1st, 2007, it's been a small charter company, Kalita Charters, that has flown the remains home. And the pilots of those planes, you know, there's a pilot and a co-pilot, and there's two caskets per plane. They'll open the door, and they'll push the nose of the casket out. And that moment is when the truth is brought home to the family. It can be several days, sometimes weeks, between notification and the actual receipt of the body. And I think families can sometimes, you know, it almost becomes abstract at that point. It's maybe it's not true. I think they sort of talked about feeling like actors in movies. But once the nose of that casket comes out, once they see the casket, once they see the flag, once they can touch it, that's the moment when reality hits home. And to bear witness to that, again, I think people need to understand the pain of that moment. I think with Dennis's voice there, you could hear it. I think we need to know that. This should not be easy for the rest of us, because it's hard for the families. It's nearly impossible for the families. And for us to brush that off, I think it's unfair to them. At the same point, there is a privacy issue there. There is a matter of respect. And my understanding is it's up to the families, the individual families, whether they want the media present at that honorable transfer. And that is the pinnacle moment in this process. Joey's mom, Gail, told me that was the hardest part, was seeing the nose of that casket pushed out of the plane. Whether we should see that or not, I think obviously it's up to the individual families. I think we at least have to know that happens.
There are other parts of this process that, I don't think anybody would want to see. Autopsies, for example, preparing the body for embalming and for viewing later before it's sent back. But these are critical parts of the process. And autopsies, you would think, for a lot of soldiers killed in combat would be pretty straightforward. In fact, they're extremely important.
Yeah, that was, I mean, not to sound cynical, but that was one of the first questions that popped into my mind when I was sort of told about the autopsies. I thought, well, it should be fairly obvious what killed this young man or woman. It would be the bullet in his chest, or it would be the explosion that happened nearby him. But in fact, the autopsy is important as much to prevent future deaths. That, for instance, the folks at Dover found that they had a number of casualties where people were killed by shrapnel wounds to the neck. And they developed an armored collar for the soldiers to wear, and they found, you know, they've dissected far fewer remains with shrapnel wounds to the neck. And so it is important to know how exactly these soldiers died, not that it was, whether there was some way to prevent it, in other words, and I think they are trying their best to do that.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Kathleen. Kathleen with us from Pleasanton, California.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate this interview. My father was recently buried from being a retired lieutenant colonel with the Army Air Guard from World War II. And it was his wish to have a military funeral, and it is not in regards, obviously, to the current veterans from the Iraq War, but I did want to comment that it was very recent that I attended the funeral, and extremely emotional, needless to say, but the meticulousness of the preparation of the coffin, the body, the flag being folded over the coffin, being presented to my mother, was all extremely moving, and that 21-gun salute at the very end of the ceremony was just beyond losing control with emotion and being so proud of what my father did for the war effort. And I just wanted to comment so heavily that I do so much appreciate what goes in to these types of ceremonies.
Chris, you describe another very moving moment having to do with the 21-gun salute. The ammunition is polished before it's fired, and then three shell casings are inserted into the flag, beautifully polished, mm-hmm. where they will never be seen.
Yeah, and that for me spoke volumes. That you know, we were just talking about the meticulousness, the effort that goes in, the work that these guys do. That's what I meant when I earlier talked about it being in some ways a life-affirming story. There are such good people out there. They really care about this. I'm actually kind of losing it right now talking.
No, it's very hard to not get emotional about it. You were just recently speaking about the bodies being taken off a plane and how much emotion must go into that. I mean, I lost it at the funeral so many times. But watching that flag being draped over my father's coffin, he was shot down in Europe. He was a navigator by the stars. He loved being in the Army Air Guard. It was so much a passion of his, and he was so proud, and burying him in his uniform and everything that went into it, and just watching that coffin go down the aisle of the church where we had the ceremony, you just get really lost in it, is what you do. And you come to such an appreciation of his accomplishments and what it meant to him.
Yeah. These funerals, I think, in some ways, they're for everybody involved. They're for the people, obviously for the families and for the person who was in that casket. But I think, you know, the active duty soldiers who are involved in these funerals, like we heard the caller earlier say it was the most important thing he ever did. That was certainly the impression I got from anybody involved, that mm-hmm. that they will never do anything as important as they do on these at these funerals.
Kathleen, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call.
Bye-bye. We're talking with Chris Jones of Esquire magazine about his article, The Things That Carried Him. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Chris, as we spill back through time from the funeral to Dover Air Force Base to Kuwait and then back to Iraq, we also learn along the way a lot about Robert Joe Montgomery, staff sergeant, who was killed at Walking Point, volunteering, as he often did, to Walk Point.
That's right. I mean, what I wanted to do, I don't know if this will make any sense, Neil. I didn't want the story to be a political story. I didn't want it to be pro-war or anti-war. What I wanted, though, was for people to see the names and the faces. It's very easy for us to say 4,000 soldiers, and that, in some ways, that's a meaningless number. It's a statistic, and we can hide behind that number. But when you actually peel back, if you actually look at a single name, a single face, his buddies who carried him back to the base, his family, and then you realize that journey has been repeated 4,000 times, that this story is just one story, but it's representative of all of them. I hope at least that people will understand, you know, how the effects that this has, that the ripple effect. I mean, if you actually consider, I spoke to 101 people who were involved in some way in Sergeant Montgomery's return, from, like you say, the buddies who carried him back. He stepped on an IED on a dirt road in southeast Baghdad, had to be carried back to his patrol base, was then driven back to Falcon, which is the operating base, helicoptered to Baghdad International Airport, flown to Camp Wolf in Kuwait, to Ramstein in Germany, to Dover, and then home to Scottsburg. Hundreds of people are involved in that process. And this affects all of them. It affects not just the soldier, you know, whose life has been lost, and not just their families, but everyone involved in this process.
Chris,
it's incredible, the ripple effect.
I'm going to read the last paragraph of your story, if you don't mind.
Sure.
The last time the platoon saw Sergeant Montgomery was later that morning at first light, Wednesday, May 23rd. They all came out of their barracks to see the helicopters land, and these sleepless young men from Colorado, from Pennsylvania, from Washington, they took hold of the poles of the stretcher, three on each side, with their friend from Indiana between them, zipped up inside a black bag tucked under a green army blanket, and they carried him into one of the Blackhawks, and they watched him lift off into the dawn and the dust, and they saluted the start of one journey and the end of another, holding their salutes all the while as the birds flew away until they were gone over the horizon. That's the last paragraph of Chris Jones's story, The Things That Carried Him. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Neil, very much.
The article appears in the May issue of Esquire magazine. And Chris Jones joined us today from the studios of the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, in Ottawa, in Canada. Coming up, the governor of Florida has said he's open to discussing reparations for slavery. Well, we've got some practical suggestions for him on the opinion page coming up next. If you'd like to get involved in that conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.